It's Thursday, September 15th. The midterms were already high stakes, and that was before a bill on national abortion bans. We start here.
This is where America should be, at the federal level.
In a move confounding Republican leaders, some lawmakers are pushing an abortion bill that would apply to all 50 states.
This is exactly what Republicans do not want to talk about.
It likely wouldn't pass until Republicans control Congress, but did that just become less likely? An entire nation mourns Queen Elizabeth. It almost seems like the entire nation wants to mourn her in person.
You saw tears. You saw expressions of love and loss from people in the crowd.
Lines are stretching across London with people waiting to pay their respects. And while interest rates were paused, some Americans raced to pay off their student debt.
They'll get a relief and a refund all at once.
Well, now those people could be getting their money back. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. The other night, we had our final state primaries of the midterm election season. And once again, we saw this weird dynamic where Democrats were rooting for the Trumpiest Republicans possible. In New Hampshire, they got their wish.
The Associated Press has now officially called the Senate race for General Don Bolduc.
Don Bolduc is a retired Army general. He's also a conspiracy theorist who once peddled the bizarre false theory that COVID vaccines contain microchips, as well as lies that raise concerns about the democratic process itself.
I signed a letter with 120 other generals and admirals saying that Trump won the election, and damn it, I stand by my election.
Despite these fictitious claims, despite raising very little money and getting no support from mainstream figures, he managed to edge out his Republican rival. And I say this because in a year where Democrats are worried about losing seats, they still think they can beat him. And this has been the question confounding Republicans for much of the year. In a political environment that seems tailor-made to the advantage of the GOP, rough economy, rough presidential approval numbers, could they still manage to lose key elections?
There's a narrative forming in America that the Republican Party and the pro-life movement is on the run. No. We're going nowhere.
Well, almost on cue, this week, a new bill started flying around Capitol Hill. A bill from South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham that would outlaw a big share of abortions nationwide. ABC's congressional correspondent Rachel Scott has been asking lawmakers at the Capitol about this. Rachel, first off, can you just walk me through this proposal?
Well, Brad, let me tell you, this really threw Republicans on Capitol Hill for a loop. We are less than 2 months out from the midterm elections, and Senator Graham comes out with a little bit of a surprise here, unexpectedly introducing a bill that would impose a nationwide ban on abortion at 15 weeks.
There is a consensus view by the most prominent pro-life groups in America that this is where America should be, at the federal level.
Very narrow exceptions in this bill to save the life of a mother, also for rape or for incest, but it would require the rape victim to at least obtain counseling or medical treatment or report it to law enforcement. And we know that rape and incest is severely underreported. But the bigger picture here, Brad, is this is the Republican Party who said that this decision should be left up to the states. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court did. They gave the power to the states. Even Senator Lindsey Graham has said that before.
The Dobbs decision is that abortion's not banned in America. It's left up to elected officials in America to define the issue. You have states have the ability to do it at the state level, and we have the ability in Washington to speak on this issue if we choose. I have chosen to speak.
At a press conference on Capitol Hill, he said that he believes if Republicans take back the Senate, that there would be a debate on this, that Republicans would vote on it, and he believes that it could pass.
Well, and so that's sort of what this would mean for women if it was passed. And again, the Senate math on this does not look clear at all that it would pass. But I'm wondering what this does for the broader politics of the moment here, Rachel, because even fellow Republicans seem kind of confused by this.
Yeah, Brad, this is exactly what Republicans do not want to talk about.
Well, with regard to his bill, you'll have to ask him about it. In terms of scheduling, I think most of the members of my conference prefer that this be dealt with at the state level.
All across the country right now, you have Republican candidates that are really forced to grapple with an issue that they have been trying to avoid. We've seen Republicans go so far as to back away from their hardline stances on abortion.
Look, I support a ban on very late term and partial birth abortion. And most Americans agree with that.
Blake Masters, the Republican candidate for Senate in Arizona, he actually scrubbed his website, removing the language that said he was 100% pro-life.
We're running to elevate the pro-life movement.
In Minnesota, you have a gubernatorial candidate, Dr. Scott Jensen. He said that he would try to ban abortion. Now he's running ads saying that in Minnesota.
It's a protected constitutional right, and no governor can change that. And I'm not running to do that.
Republicans have been looking at what recently happened in Kansas, the conservative state overwhelmingly voting to protect abortion rights.
It's a huge victory for Kansas, for women, for reproductive rights.
It sends a message that the women are coming out of the woodworks. Like, we are not going anywhere.
And we know by looking at the data that more women have been registering to vote weeks after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. They know that this is energizing the Democratic base.
But I think what you're seeing there is a conflict within the Republican Party. There are those in the party that think life begins at the candlelight dinner the night before.
And they want to just stay away from it. They want to focus on inflation. They want to focus on the economy. And this recent announcement by Senator Lindsey Graham is really overshadowing all of that.
Is this a risky strategy when it comes to messaging ahead of the midterms?
So here's what I think. Most Americans do not support late-term abortions.
And when I talk to Republicans on Capitol Hill, from Senator Mitt Romney.
Do you support that 15-week nationwide ban on abortion?
I haven't seen what Senator Graham has proposed. It doesn't sound like that's going to be brought to the floor anytime soon.
To Senator James Lankford.
Do you think that that's an effective messaging bill? Where do you think the focus should be?
So I think the focus should be on inflation.
They told me that the focus needs to be redirected.
But so, Rachel, like, if Republican consultants are saying, please, please don't do this, like, please don't touch on these social issues that alienate a lot of voters, I mean, Democrats are leaning into social issues, right? They have their own bill that would enshrine same-sex marriage in federal law. I mean, if we're talking about alienating voters, how are Democrats approaching the next couple months?
For Democrats this midterm election, it is all about reminding voters what exactly is at stake.
The MAGA Republicans are taking over the Republican Party. And they've made it abundantly clear they're not satisfied with repealing Roe.
So they are using Roe versus Wade being overturned to say that other rights could also be in jeopardy, not just the issue of abortion. But what about same-sex marriage? So right now on Capitol Hill, Democrats are trying to gather enough votes to put a bill on the floor in the Senate that would basically protect same-sex marriage under federal law. They need at least 10 Republicans to do it. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is eyeing that vote before the midterms, and that would put every single Republican in the Senate on the record on this issue, Brad.
Okay, we'll see what happens there on Capitol Hill. Rachel Scott, our congressional correspondent, thanks.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, everyone on hand has been solemn, except the ones who have gotten arrested. The quiet struggle among people who don't want a queen or a king after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
A British friend told me once that she loves lining up for stuff. British people love an orderly queue, she said. It's like a national pastime. You see a queue, you jump in the queue. But the sheer number of people that wanted to get in line to see the late Queen Elizabeth just one more time, that might even test London's abilities. Officials estimated 750,000 people, yes, 750,000, might join this line that stretched across the Thames yesterday and finally started moving as her coffin arrived. Let's go to ABC's chief foreign correspondent, Ian Pannell, who's witnessing all this in London. And Ian, I guess, can you walk me through the remarkable scenes inside, but perhaps even more remarkable were these scenes outside Westminster Abbey?
Yes, it really was a remarkable, memorable, and truly historic day. You were first struck by the silence outside Buckingham Palace. Bear in mind, this is central London, midday. Even the planes stopped flying from Heathrow for a little while so they wouldn't disturb the peace on the ground. You could have heard a pin drop, and then suddenly you could hear the drummers. You almost feel the reverberation. Then you heard the guns firing. And then this procession, this funeral cortege, slowly marching, moving its way up along the Mall and eventually to Westminster as the Queen's coffin passed by. And the interesting thing happened. You saw tears.
I didn't expect to feel this way. And it's just hit me on that Thursday as it did everyone else. Yeah, very emotional.
You know us Brits, we're famously stiff upper-lipped. Well, yesterday really was different. Yesterday was a chance to show emotion, to show respect, obviously not for everyone in the country, but for those who chose to come down and see the procession, and those who chose to stand and will continue to today, tomorrow, and right through until Monday the 19th, stand in line, possibly up to as long as 30 hours.
Wow.
Although the line seemed to move fairly quickly, to wait and pay their respects to the Queen, who's now lying in state in the Houses of Westminster in Westminster Hall.
Wow. And like you said, everyone who shows up, of course, these deep sentiments for the Queen. That doesn't necessarily apply to everyone in Britain. And you've actually done some reporting on sort of the royal finances, what Charles, you know, could he be the next billionaire king, essentially? And it's funny because when we talk about a prime minister taking over, of course, that's the question. Are they connected to regular people experiencing regular problems? And I wonder if Charles is going to have that same kind of reckoning.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to be struck by the pomp and circumstance and the vast expense of a funeral of this magnitude.
Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
At a time when Brits are hurting.
UK inflation is forecast to soar past 18%.
Like on your side of the pond, you know, inflation is up, energy prices are up, food bills are up, and there are dire warnings about what the winter will bring for many people having to choose in Britain in 2022 between food and heat.
We have no buffer. We have no savings. We've got no credit card to fall back on. Nobody's going to give us any money. We're just going to fall off a financial cliff.
Times are hard for many, many people out there. And it's not just really the juxtaposition between this kind of lavish funeral that we witnessed, but actually between the wealth that Prince Charles will now inherit from his mother, from the Queen, the Duchy of Lancaster in particular, one of the largest property holding enterprises in the country, but also by the fact that he, unlike most of his subjects, is not obliged to pay the 40% inheritance tax.
Monarchists argue that they bring in money through tourism. Republicans argue that that's not really measurable. And that
it's a tough level of tax. Well, Charles is not obliged to pay that, whether he does or not.
I know there are lots of Americans with thoughts about inheritance taxes, but you're saying the UK's got a really stiff one, and for some reason the king's the only one that doesn't have to pay it?
Yeah, the guy who's getting a whopping tens and tens and tens of millions of pounds. This was a rule. It was originally designed that if there had been a rapid succession of monarchs, that by the end of it, you could see the crown diminish to the point where it had no wealth and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the monarchy as we know it. And you wouldn't be able to hold a lavish funeral like you can right now. But that obviously isn't the case right now. And I think many people will feel that is unfair. It is unjust.
They are quite wealthy already. Don't see why they need my taxes.
And I think this goes to the heart of what I think will be a problem for Charles. There was a lot of latitude given to the Queen because of the length of her service, because she came from a different era, and we'd all grown up with her. I'm not so sure the same credit will be extended to Charles.
And then does that also mean that, because there are anti-royalist voices both within the UK and, of course, many outside the UK. Are those voices getting louder in a way that you can see, or is that completely off the radar because of all the pomp and circumstance right now?
I mean, you could be forgiven for not noticing it so clearly here, but yes, it's absolutely there, especially amongst Commonwealth countries.
We don't feel the way the rest of the world feel. In fact, the British people must give our land back, our diamonds back, our heritage.
I think many may have stuck by the Queen even though the majority of populations there felt it was time to sever links, that the colonial past is not a great history for them.
You can't have any philosophical or moral justification for one family having political power like that.
It's a history perhaps of abusive relations, of exploitation, and I think many people feel it's time to move into the modern era.
God save the king!
We saw a number of incidents over the last few days where there were protests. People standing, holding signs saying, not my king, or abolish the monarchy. And there were a number of arrests made. I mean, there were a couple of incidents in particular outside the Houses of Commons. One in which a woman held a sign saying, not my king. That was it. And she was surrounded by the police and ushered away. And a barrister watched this on TV or saw it on social media, and he went out and held up a blank piece of paper and had exactly the same thing happen to him.
I was holding up a blank sign. Okay. Why are you asking for my details?
You said you're going to write stuff on it that may offend people.
I said I was going to write not my king. Okay. Honestly.
Now, the last time someone got arrested, to be fair, he wasn't arrested. He was taken away, moved out of that spot. The last time we've seen that happen actually is in somewhere like Red Square under Vladimir Putin.
I was going to say that's a Russian protest tactic.
Yeah, exactly right. Now, listen, the police have been widely berated. Commanders have had to remind police officers that this is not what you do. They say, of course, people have the right to protest.
Largo!
Be quiet.
That's free speech! Largo!
It's a very sensitive time. I mean, brave is the person who's willing to stand up on a street corner right now and say abolish the monarchy. But that doesn't mean that the sentiment isn't there. The response of the police was certainly unfortunate at very best. As I say, I think there is an undercurrent in the country. It's not the majority by any means, but it won't take many missteps, I think, by the monarchy for pressure to grow, I think, to change. And of course, these are reflected in generations. The older you get, the more support for the monarchy. But again, over time, that of course dissipates, and the younger generation have very different views of how they see Britain and how they want to be represented in the world.
And just to compare and contrast all these visuals, all these sights and sounds taking place across London, just such raw emotion at this very intense time. Ian Pannell in London, thanks for breaking it down.
Thanks, Brad.
When President Biden announced he was unilaterally canceling up to $20,000 worth of student debt for millions of Americans, he got really strong reactions, but from different angles. For many conservatives, this was an almost obscene act of generosity to Americans who didn't need it, prioritizing those with college degrees over those without.
It's very unfair, to have a truck driver have to pay back a loan from somebody that got like a PhD in gender studies. That's not fair.
But there was also criticism from groups on the left saying this plan didn't do nearly enough to assist people who are now trapped under mountains of debt they were told they needed to take on to get ahead.
If we believe education is the fundamental right for folks in America, then higher education really should be free.
And from both of these groups was an obvious question. What about the people who have been working this whole time to continue paying off their debts? Well, yesterday, the government said if you are eligible for this program and you had been dutifully repaying your debt during this pandemic, you're about to get refunded. ABC Cheyenne Hazlett has been covering the student debt debate. Cheyenne, it's one thing to say we're not going to collect this money, you can keep it. It's quite another to say we're going to pay back this money that we've already collected, that's already in our coffers. How is this about to work?
Well, that is a good point, and we should probably keep some healthy skepticism around the actual execution of this for sure. But the Department of Education has decided that it'll automatically refund people who made payments since March of 2020 when they didn't have to because there was a pause throughout the pandemic. And these refunds aren't going to go to everyone. They're just going to go to people who qualify for debt forgiveness under this new policy.
The Department of Education will lay out in detail a short and simple form to apply for this relief, along with information when this application process opens.
So the way it'll work is that when people go to apply, which they can do starting in early October, according to the administration, they'll get a relief and a refund all at once.
I'll be in debt probably about $40,000. So the $10,000, even though it's not the whole bit, it's at least something that helps.
And the administration has previously said that relief will come around 4 to 6 weeks after people submit those applications. So we could expect to see the refunds coming at that same time, too. Though I will say again, experts are wary that the bureaucracy can move this quickly.
How much money are we talking about here, and how many people would get it?
We know that there are around 9 million people who made at least one payment between April of 2020 and March of 2022, and that's according to the Office of Federal Student Aid. So that's who this policy is for.
I'm not waiting around. I'm getting rid of these student loans once and for all.
And interestingly, another 1.9 million people paid off their accounts during that time.
The federal student loans were paused, both payments and interest, starting in 2020. You know why? We're not going to get into it. We all know why. And so that helped out a lot of people, including myself, because one, we did not have to pay student loans, and two, no interest was accruing, so we were saving a lot of money.
And for those people, since they no longer qualify for the forgiveness, advocacy groups are encouraging them to go straight to their student loan servicers and ask for that money back, because they won't qualify for that automatic refund since they won't qualify for the forgiveness in the first place.
Oh, because you just show up with a balance of zero in the system at this point. No one thinks you need any debt forgiveness, but if you want to get the automatic refunds, you got to appear in the system as somebody who still has some outstanding debt. Cheyenne, I do think there's been sort of this debate over a lot of kitchen tables in the last several weeks, and the question seems to be, who needs a break on their student loans? Like, who truly needs it? Because certainly not every college student is rich or privileged, but if there's one group of students you might have thought would be okay, it would be someone who's been told for 2 years, you don't have to pay us back right now. Like, don't worry about it. Keep yourself afloat. And they're paying back these loans anyways. Like, why would that be the person who needs the help right now?
Yeah, definitely the entire political divide on this issue comes down to that question. Who deserves to have their debt forgiven?
Why forgive loans that someone is knowingly, they're signing something saying that I'm taking on this debt, I'm responsible for this debt, and then complain after they pick a job that doesn't pay their debt.
And Republicans have made that argument even before this small update to the larger plan.
If you paid your student loan, guess what? Now you get to participate in paying someone else's student loan.
So they have said that, you know, married people who make $250,000 a year as a joint household, which is the income cap, you know, which is up from that $125K a year for just an individual. If, say, only one spouse works, but they make $250,000 a year together, they could have their debt forgiven here. And that, Republicans argue, is not fair. But on the flip side, some Democrats say that this policy is not really going to help people like that. For example, Pell Grant recipients, who largely come from families with incomes of $60,000 or less, they're the ones who will get up to $20,000 in debt forgiven. And those Pell Grant recipients make up the vast majority of people with debt.
This income cap doesn't really meet the mark for folks who are just coming into wealth now after going through college.
But the interesting thing here is that actually that income cap, which Democrats have really clung to as a political life raft to show that they're not going to give money to people who don't need it, it's actually the thing that student debt advocacy groups are angry about. Because basically they say that without that income cap, the Department of Education could just make this debt relief automatic, like it's doing with this automatic refund, which is a win for student debt advocacy groups who say that it makes the whole process a little bit easier. But because of that income cap, the government is blocking a small percentage of wealthy people from getting relief and potentially doing the same to marginalized people who either won't know about the relief program and won't apply, or won't have the necessary paperwork to apply, or maybe even the technology. So you could lose people from the group you're trying to help. That's why some of these advocacy groups argue for total cancellation of all different incomes.
That is fascinating, that in kind of creating this olive branch to conservatives, this sort of extra paperwork you need to fill out to show that you, you know, aren't one of the super wealthy in this country, just by creating that paperwork, you're actually excluding some of the neediest people in this country. So I guess this automatic refund thing, kind of the olive branch to the far left. Cheyenne Hazlett, really useful. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, giving away your money is one thing, but a billionaire just gave away his entire company. One last thing is next. And one last thing. Lots of billionaires say they're committed to giving their money away to worthy causes, but one billionaire just gave away his whole company.
Not a lot of people understand how serious we are about saving this planet. I'm dead serious.
Yvon Chouinard said he never wanted to own a business in the first place. He was a rock climber, what people around Yosemite would call a dirtbag, living out of a van, eating cat food to save up gas money. But over the years, his little company, Patagonia, has become one of the most respected outdoor clothing brands in the world.
You know, fashion is a very powerful force in society.
While other retail moguls might drive around their Benz, he famously drives his beat-up Subaru. And yesterday, in an interview with the New York Times, Chouinard revealed that instead of cashing out his shares, he's going to leave the company while still ensuring all of its profits, every dollar, are devoted to saving the planet.
I've always believed that there's only one way to lead, and that's by example.
Financial advisors actually had to come up with a brand new way of doing what he wanted. Usually, if you're done with the family business, you pass it along to a family member. He said none of his kids wanted it, plus he didn't want to create more billionaires anyway. Others might take Patagonia public and donate the proceeds, but he didn't want shareholder concerns to compromise his famously eco-friendly brand.
When I see nature being destroyed, I feel like I gotta do something about it.
Instead, the company will remain a for-profit venture run by a trust, but all of the profits will go into this new organization that just received 98% of the family shares. That organization's sole job is to just donate Patagonia's profits, about $100 million a year, to earth-friendly causes.
That's why I continue hanging on to this company, because it's my resource to do something good.
And again, to compare, when billionaires participate in a giving pledge, they donate a chunk of change, but they get huge tax breaks. The remainder keeps making them a profit for the remainder of their lives. Chouinard structured this so that he gave away his company without any tax breaks and without any way to get it back. This move is irreversible, and he's hoping climate change can be halted before that becomes irreversible too. Dude said part of the reason he wanted to give this company away quickly was he was so successful he saw himself climbing on the Forbes list of billionaires and got so angry because, in his words, every billionaire is a policy failure. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.